All right. Well, y'all know what I'm going to say, so here we go. Turn with me, if you will, to the place where this week's Torah portion begins, and that would be the book of Numbers, or Bamidbar, in the wilderness, chapter 4. We didn't get all the way through chapter 4 last time. We paused at the place where it says again, and Yehoshua spoke to Moshe, verse 21, so that's where you want to go. And in verse 22 is technically where it begins, and it says again, take the sum, or lift up the head, nasa et rosh, lift up the head, do a head count, of the sons of Gershon. So we've been talking about the other two tribes that are the sons of Levi, now it's Gershon, also by their father's houses, by their families. And again, it's from 30 years old and up to age 50, you number them. And notice that since we're counting different age groups, we're going to get different numbers than we would have seen, at least proportionally, with respect to some of the other censuses or head counts that we've seen. This is the service of the families of the Gershonites, it says, in serving and in bearing burden. So it's going to go through what they are required to do. But what I want to pause just for a second and say, look, as we get into this portion, I'm calling this breakdown tonight, Naso Plus. So the portion is called Naso, again from Take the Sum, Naso et Rosh. But the thing that I think is interesting, of course, is we got a little bit out of kilter with the regular rabbinic division of the Torah portions. The reason is because I didn't want to do the double portions where they had them going. That means we got to do some double portions elsewhere. And because these are longer portions, it's a little bit more difficult to get caught up. But I think I have figured out how I'm going to do that. So we're going to go through the portion called Naso. And as we get there, you'll see that we're going to go into the next portion as well. And there's a method to that madness. And we'll get there in a few minutes. But in any case, the description here is going to be of the duties of the Gershonites. They're going to bear the curtains of the tabernacle, tent of meeting, its covering, the sealskin above it, the screen for the door, the hangings, the screen for the door of the court, all the things round about, the cords, instruments of their service, whatever has to do with them. These are the things that they'll do to serve. And at the commandment of Aaron and his sons, well, in other words, they are going to report to him, shall be the service of the sons of the Gershonites, all their burden and their service. You shall appoint unto them in charge of all their burden. This, it says, is the service of the families of the sons of the Gershonites in the Ohel, the tent of meeting. And their charge shall be under, specifically, the hand of Ithamar, son of Aaron the Kohen. Now, as for the sons of Merari, you shall number them by their families, fathers' houses. Again, 30 years up to age 50, number them. Everyone that enters into the service to do the work of the tent of meeting. And here it says is their charge, according to all their service in the tent of meeting, boards of the tabernacle, bars, pillars, sockets. The pillars of the court round about, all their sockets, pins, and cords, all that it pertains to them, and all that pertains to their service. And by name you shall appoint the instruments of the charge of their burden. This, it says, is the service of the families of the sons of Merari, according to all their service in the tent of meeting, under the hand, again, of Ithamar, son of Aaron the Kohen. And Moshe and Aaron and the princes of the congregation numbered, as they were told, the sons of the Kohathites by their families, by their fathers' houses. Again, 30 years old, upwards to 50, everyone that enters into the service. We notice the pattern is similar and consistent. That's one of the things that I think is interesting about this portion. It also makes people think it's repetitive, but I'm going to continue to contend that there's no idle word in Torah and that there are some specific points. We may not always understand or agree on what they are, but the fact that they're spending, that the Creator is spending the ink here tells us that it's important. And I think one of probably multiple lessons is there is a consistency to the description because there's a consistency to the duties. So, it's 30 to 50. They're all entering into the service, those that were numbered. And what we're going to see at this point as we do a recap is we're going to actually get that head count. So, when it comes to the Kohathites, those that were numbered, 2,750. These are they that were numbered of the families of the Kohathites, all that did serve in the tent of meeting, whom Moshe and Aaron numbered according to the commandment of Yahuwah by the hand of Moshe. On to Gershon, those that were numbered by their families, fathers' houses, 30 years up to 50. Everyone that entered the service for the Ohel, the tent of meeting, those who were numbered by their of them, by their families, by their fathers' houses, this time 2,630. We're going to see the same phraseology for the families of the sons of Gershon, all that served in the tent of meeting, as commanded by Moshe and Aaron, by Yahuwah in turn. they went and they were numbered. And the answer here, from 30 to 50 years of age, those that were numbered were 3,200. So these are they, it says, that were numbered of the families of the sons of Merari, whom Moshe and Aaron numbered, according to the commandment of Yahuwah by the hand of Moshe. All of those. Now we're going to get the combined numbers here. So this is another way we can cross-check, of course. All those that were numbered of the Levites, so all of those families, whom Moshe and Aaron and the princes of Israel numbered by their families, by their fathers' houses, again, age 30 through 50, everyone that entered to do the work of service in bearing the burdens of the Ohel of meeting, those that were numbered of them, 8,580. According to the commandment of Yahuwah, they were appointed by the hand of Moshe, every one to his service and to his burden. They also were numbered as Yahuwah commanded Moshe. Now, chapter 5 is going to get a change of tone and of impact. Now we're going to see some very interesting specifics, and these are kind of unique in the Torah. The first one is, we're going to kind of work up to it with this one. Command the children of Israel that they put out, they shalach, right? Separate, send out, expel, exile, at least temporarily, of the camp, everyone who is a metzora, all right? In other words, that has this thing called zara'at, and this often gets overlooked, and everyone that has an issue, so in other words, they've got some seepage somewhere, some kind of a weeping sore or whatever the case may be, and whoever is unclean by the dead. So if they are in contact with the dead and therefore they are unclean, they too go out of the camp for that period of time. Both male and female you put outside the camp. Outside your camp you put them so that they do not defile the camp in the midst thereof where I dwell. And the children of Israel, it said, did so. They put them outside the camp, and as Yahuwah spoke unto Moshe, so they did. And we continue. And Yahuwah spoke unto Moshe, and he said again more, speak unto the B'nai Israel. So this is a command to everybody. When a man or a woman commits any sin that men commit, to commit a trespass against Yahuwah, and that soul is guilty, then they shall confess their sin, which they've done, and make restitution for his guilt in full. And add to that the fifth part, so it's another fifth or 20%, and give that to the person in whom, respect of whom, he has been guilty, who's been wrong, who's been trespassed. Rashi's comment is, yeah, that you give to the one that you owe the money to. All right? So no Robin Hood here. And when there is a problem, there's not only restitution made, it's 20% more. But if the man doesn't have any near kin to whom restitution may be made for the guilt, that restitution for guilt is instead belongs to Yahuwah. That means it goes to the priest, the Kohen, besides the ram of the atonement, whereby atonement shall be made for him. So the Kohen gets it if there's no kin. And every heave offering of all of the set-apart things of the B'nai Israel, which you present unto the Kohen, they'll be his. And every man's hallowed thing shall be his. Whenever, whatsoever any man gives to the Kohen, it shall be his. Now we're going to see this. Yahuwah spoke to Moshe, and he said. Now, I'm going to pause here and introduce this one. This is an interesting section. It's one that I certainly spend some time talking about every year. Right now, we're just going to read through most of the specifics. We'll probably talk about more details tomorrow, because this connects to an amazing number of places in Scripture. And once you begin to see the pattern here, you'll say, wow, this is a theme that percolates throughout the book. And that would include Yahushua and the Garden of Gethsemane, for example. Speak unto the B'nai Israel and say to them, if a man's wife goes astray and acts unfaithfully towards him, in other words, if she commits adultery, and some man does the dirty deed, lies with her carnally, and the husband doesn't see it, it's hidden from his eyes, but she's defiled secretly, there's no witness against her. Notice, he's making this very specific. We don't have a witness, we don't have two witnesses, it's done in secret, and nor was she taken in the act. Then, if the spirit of jealousy comes upon him, and he's jealous of his wife, and she's defiled, or if this ruach of kana comes upon him, he's jealous of his wife, and she's not defiled. In other words, wait a minute, it's possible he's wrong, right? It's possible he has this jealous spirit that comes upon him, but he don't know what's going on, and he's wrong. Well, the thing about this is considered to be, and I can certainly say, I can't say that it's not true, the sages have said anyway, this is the only commandment and procedure or process that is laid out in the Torah for which a miracle is required. So think about that. This is one where the Creator promises, you go through this, and we're going to tell you, she's guilty or she's not. You're going to know. And it requires a miracle for that to happen. So it's unique in that sense. And I guess it's also unique because if you think about it, this is one of the things that men in their idolatrous relationships with other gods, their adulteries, in other words, before him, actually did. So it has a special place in all of the number of things that might be done. Okay, so again, either she's guilty or she's not. Well, the process is the man shall bring his wife unto the Kohen, and he brings an offering for her. That offering is a tenth part of an ephah of barley meal. He doesn't put any oil on it. He doesn't put frankincense on it, because it's a meal offering, a mincha of jealousy, kana. A meal offering of memorial to bring Torahlessness to remembrance. And that's an interesting phrase, isn't it? She has been Torahless, or has she? But whatever it is, it's going to bring that to remembrance. And the Kohen shall bring her near. He sets her before Yahuwah. At this point, some interesting things happen. He takes set apart water. Water that is Mayim Chayim, Kadosh water, in an earthen vessel of the dust that's on the floor of the tabernacle. The priest takes. He puts it in the water. So he takes something from the dirt, the floor, adds it into the water. The priest then sets the woman before Yahuwah, and he lets the hair of her head go loose. So this is one of several places. There's obviously a lot of contention about head coverings and so forth and what it says, but this is one of the few places in the Torah where we actually see something explicit about it. And what he's doing is, I think the context is real clear. He is setting her before Yahuwah. He removes her head covering, if any, and now her hair is let down, and she is, if you will, uncovered before Yahuwah. Then he puts that meal offering, the mincha of memorial, in her hands, the meal offering of jealousy, of kana, and the Kohen shall wave or have in his hand the water of bitterness that causes the curse. So, that's the other name for what's going on here. Remember, he has taken water in an earthen vessel. It's set apart. It's holy water, if you will. And this is not the same thing as the Catholics talk about, because this would probably mean, as the way I've always read it, and I don't think you're going to find too much disagreement, but I'm sure there's some somewhere, that this would be the water of the ashes of the red heifer. But anyway, he puts it in the water, the dust, and we're going to see some other things. So that's what it refers to when it says he has in his hand the water of bitterness. He causes her to swear, says to the woman, if no man has lain with you, and if you have not gone aside to uncleanness. Now I'm going to read the English, and then we're going to go back and see what it really says. Being under your husband, then be free from this water of bitterness that causes the curse. So, if you're innocent, no problem. You're free from this. But if not, if you have gone aside, being under your husband, and if you're defiled because some other man has committed adultery with you, have lain with you besides your husband or in place of, then she's going to make a certain swear and some bad things are going to happen. But let's pause because there's an important phrase there that I think we certainly want to pay attention to. It appears twice. If no man has lain with you, have not gone aside, being under your husband. And it's repeated in verses 19 and 20. Now the trouble is, that's not actually what the Hebrew says. And I think that's fascinating because this is this word, and I'm always kind of interested when I see this word appear, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, right? We know that it's not an eye for an eye. It's an eye in place of. So the Hebrew says tachat, an eye in place of an eye, a tooth in place of a tooth. Ein tachat ein. Well, guess what? It's the same word here. So it's not under your husband, it's tachat. This actually, I think, makes more sense. In place of your husband, right? Your husband's supposed to be doing that. You have put somebody in his place. That's literally what the Hebrew says. And notice it says it twice. If you've gone aside and replaced your husband, somebody in place of your husband, and you're defiled because some other man has done this thing with you besides your husband, in place of him, then The woman is to swear this oath of cursing, and the priest shall say unto the woman, and Yahuwah make you a curse and an oath among your people. So Yahuwah make you a curse and an oath among your people. When Yahuwah does make your thigh to rot or fall away, and your belly to swell. And this water which causes the curse will go into your bowels and make your belly swell and your thigh to fall away. And the woman shall say, Amen, Amen. Then the curse is written on a scroll by the Kohen. So he literally writes the curse down. He blots it out with that same water that is in the cup. And now he makes the woman drink the water of bitterness that causes the curse. And the water that causes the curse, it says, shall enter into her and become bitter. So let's pause there. Again, here is the miracle. And we're going to see that there are some specifics that happen. But the first part is her thigh rots, her belly swells if she's guilty. If not, nothing happens. But there's more. Kohen then takes the minchah of jealousy out of the woman's hand. He waves that minchah before Yahuwah, and he brings it to the altar. Now he takes a handful of the minchah as a memorial part thereof, so a little part, and he makes it smoke upon the altar, and then after that, the woman drinks the water. Now when he's made her drink the water, it shall come to pass, if she has actually committed adultery, if she's defiled and has acted unfaithfully against her husband, then, well, we know this, the water that causes the curse enters into her, becomes bitter, and her belly shall swell and her thigh shall fall away, and the woman shall be a curse among her people. So there's kind of the miracle part one, and you would expect that, depending on what's in the water, something bad might happen, but the specifics here do sound miraculous if she's guilty, and after all, who knows whether she's guilty or not, except the woman and the one who she now stands without a head covering before, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. On the other hand, if she's not defiled, but she's instead clean, not only shall she be cleared because nothing happens, but when she's reunited with her husband, she shall conceive seed. So this is a blessing. This, it says, is the Torah of Ha-Kanot, plural, of jealousies. When a wife being takes someone in place of her husband, goes aside and is defiled. So she has allowed someone to take her husband's place, goes aside, she's defiled. Or, if it happens that this Ruach Kana, the spirit of jealousy, comes upon a man, and he's jealous over his wife, but it turns out he's wrong, then he shall set the woman before Yahuwah, the Kohen shall execute upon her all of this instruction, this Torah. And the man, it says, now this is different than we're going to see here in this same book, Numbers chapter 30. Normally, the husband bears the wife's Torahlessness. But of course, the entire setup here and the fact that she sits before Yahuwah without a covering makes it clear. He is clear from Torahlessness and iniquity. And the woman, if she's guilty, she bears that herself. Chapter 6 says, Now Yahuwah spoke to Moshe, saying, Speak unto the men of Israel, say to them, When a man or a woman, either one, clearly utters a vow. Now, this is a very specific vow, and this vow is called a Nazarite vow, the vow of a Netzer, to consecrate himself unto Yahuwah. Now, I've always thought this one was kind of fascinating. I won't go into a lot of detail here. We're just going to read it. But notice there are any number of vows that people might make, but this one is kind of unique in Scripture because it's given a lot of detail. We're also going to see examples of people, famously, Samson, who was a Nazarite from birth, and evidently a lot of scholars will say, yeah, so was John the Baptist. Certainly the description of John the Baptist with long hair and all that sounds like he too was a Nazarite from birth. So anyway, those are the two that are generally said to kind of stand out in Scripture, but a whole lot of other folks took it, including Shaul or Paul, and that was after people thought he had done away with the law. And it turns out, no, he hadn't at all. And nor were these sacrifices done away with when a lot of the whore church claims that they were, because Paul's proven that that's not the case. He follows through with the things that are done right here in this section. So, this person has decided to, male or female, consecrate himself unto Yahuwah. And I've heard it described as kind of a little bit of a taste of what it's like to be a Kohen. Don't know how true that is, but the normal person doesn't generally have that option. But here's a specific that at least seems to give them some indication in that direction. And there are several specifics associated with it. One, He shall abstain from wine and strong drink. Indeed, he drinks no vinegar of wine or the vinegar of strong drink, nor shall he drink any liquor made of grapes, nor even eat fresh grapes or raisins. So anything associated with grapes, he stays clear of. All the days of his Nazariteship, he shall eat nothing that has or is made from the grapevine, from pressed grapes, or even the grape stone. So he can't even have grape nuts. Of course, those aren't made from grapes, but you get the idea. All the days of his vow of Nazariteship, there is no razor that comes upon his head. So here's part two. He lets his hair grow long. Till the days be fulfilled in which he's consecrated himself unto Yahuwah, he shall be set apart. He lets the locks of his hair on his head grow long. All the days that he consecrates himself to Yahuwah, he shall not come near a dead body. So there's the third part. He doesn't make himself unclean, not even if it's his father or his mother or his brother or his sister, if they die, because his consecration to Elohim is upon his head. So this is something we've seen before. Those that are set apart to Yah avoid to the greatest extent possible, and there are some different definitions for different folks and how near of kin, but concept here, even if it's his father, mother, brother, or sister, he does not go near the dead body because his consecration to Yahuwah is upon his head. All the days of his Nazarite vow, he is set apart to Yahuwah. Now, if somebody suddenly dies next to the guy, right? Somebody took the COVID poke, and they have a tendency to do that. They die suddenly, and he's next to the guy, or in the same room, or whatever, and that defiles his consecrated head. Well, now he's in trouble. He literally has a reset. He's not supposed to do it. He didn't do it on purpose, but it happened anyway. Somebody dies next to him suddenly. He has to shave his head on the day of his cleansing. On the seventh day, he shaves it. So he saves it. He goes through the process that is having to do with cleansing from a dead body. And on the eighth day, he brings two turtle doves or two young pigeons to the Kohen, to the door of the tent of meeting. This is a process we've seen before. The Kohen prepares one for a chatat, sin offering, the other for a burnt offering, and Olah makes atonement for him. Because he sinned, even though it was unintentional, by reason of the dead, he hollows his head that same day. And he shall consecrate unto Yahuwah the days of his Nazariteship. He brings a he-lamb of the first year for a guilt offering. But the former days are void. In other words, it's a reset. He starts over because his consecration, however long he was into it, is defiled. He has the whole vow to do over again. This, it says, is the Torah of the Nazarite. When the days of his consecration are fulfilled, he brings it to the door of the tent of meeting, presents his offering unto Yahuwah. One he-lamb, first year without blemish, for an olah, burnt offering, one ewe lamb of the first year without blemish, for a chatat, sin offering, one ram without blemish, for peace offerings, shalamim. Now you can see why this was a big deal that Shaul paid for those other people, as we see in the book of Acts, and for himself, when he was essentially ending his Nazarite vow to prove that he wasn't what the whole church makes him out to be, anti-Torah. And also he brings a basket of unleavened bread, cakes of fine flour mingled with oil, unleavened wafers spread with oil, and the mincha, the meal offering, and their drink offerings. The Kohen brings them before Yahuwah, and he offers his chatat and his olah. And he offers the ram for a sacrifice of shalamim unto Yahuwah. Along with the basket of unleavened bread, the Kohen offers also the mincha, the meal offering, and the drink offering. The Nazarite now, he's let his hair grow long for this entire time. He shaves his consecrated head at the door of the tent of meeting. He takes the hair of his consecrated head, puts it on the fire, which is under the sacrifice of Shalamim. So it burns his hair. Cohen then takes the shoulder of that ram when it's sodden, one unleavened cake out of the basket, one unleavened wafer, puts them on the hands of the Nazarite. After he has shaved his consecrated head, the priest now waves them for a wave offering before Yahuwah. This is set apart kadosh for the priest, along with the breast of waving and the thigh of heaving. After that, the Nazarite is, well, he's done, and he can again drink wine. So this, it says, this process is the Torah of the Nazarite, who vows and of his offering unto Yahuwah for his Nazariteship, besides that's for which his means suffice. So in other words, as you can see, it's a fairly expensive process when he's done. According to the vows which he vows, he must do after the Torah of his Nazariteship. So there are now two things that are essentially part of this chapter that we're seeing are different, somewhat unique, that are described, processes. Now it says Yahuwah spoke to Moshe, and he said, here's a third process. It's unique, but it's different in a whole different way. We're going to recognize this one, too. Speak unto Aaron and unto his sons, and say to them, here is how you shall bless the B'nai Israel. Well, we do this relatively frequently. Here it is. This is the place where the priestly blessing appears in the Scripture. This is what you say to them. Yivarekecha Yehovah v'ishmarecha, Yair Yehovah panavalecha v'ichenecha, Isayahu panavalecha v'yasim lecha shalom. Yehovah bless you and keep you. Yehovah make his face to shine upon you and be gracious unto you. Yehovah lift up his countenance upon you and give you his shalom, peace. And it says, this is how, so shall they put Shemi, my name, upon the B'nai Israel, and I myself shall bless them. Now, I will make a quick note here, because it's interesting. The Midrash points out that in the beginning, and if you look at Genesis, you see it's Yahuwah that blesses people. He blesses Adam v'Chava. And then later, we see that there's the situation with Noah, and he blesses them. And then eventually we get to Abraham, and he seems to be the first one who is given this idea that I will bless those who blessed you, and you will bless others. We see him blessing some people in turn. So it looks like Abraham, or Avram at that point, is the first human to bless other people. And we see that with Melchizedek, the king, and the king of Shalom. And we're also going to see that later on he blesses Isaac, and then Isaac passes down that blessing, and the blessing through Isaac and Yaakov and his sons passes to us. And then, of course, Levite. The Levites are one of those groups, and the Kohanim a subset of those. But it looks like at this point what we understand is lots of people are blessing one another. I hear people say, oh no, only the Kohen should give the blessing. I don't necessarily believe that. But I do think it says, here's how you bless the B'nai Israel, and here's what you say to them. So this was a blessing that was written for us, at least. It was spoken to Aaron and unto his sons, but on the other hand, today we don't have the sons. We don't even know who they are anymore. So I don't have a problem with this idea of suggesting we know the blessing, we should understand it and use it. All right, chapter 7 is interesting. This is a couple things. One, it's the longest chapter in not just the Torah, but looks like it's the longest chapter in the whole book. It's also, arguably, one of the most repetitive. And there's a certain, I would say that too is kind of fascinating. Why so much ink? And furthermore, why is it so repetitive? I can think of some other interesting reasons as somebody has a background in information theory and coding and error correction and so forth. It makes errors real easy to detect. It also, if there are longer code patterns in the Torah and all that kind of stuff, it has kind of fascinating impacts there. I don't claim that that's the reason for it, because I think there are other reasons too, but it may be part of a huge overall reason why the Creator decided to put this chapter in the way he did. One thing we do know is that all these blessings are identical except for the names of the individuals involved, and they're all important. And as we go through it, we'll see some of that. I'm not going to read all of it because it would literally probably take us close to an hour to read through all of this. I encourage people to read it, even if you think it's repetitive, because I believe that, well, there's no idle word in Torah. There's a blessing in here. But what we're going to do is we're going to see, I'll do some representatives of it, and then we'll go through some of the differences because we have a long way to go tonight and some other things we're going to talk about. And we'll see how that fits, too, in a minute. So it came to pass on the day that Moshe had made an end of setting up the Mishkan, the tabernacle. He had anointed it, set it apart, sanctified it, all the furniture, the altar, the vessels, anointed and sanctified them. So in other words, all of this is done. The Kohanim, the princes of Israel, the heads of their father's houses, offered. These, now it says, were the princes of the tribes. They were over those that were numbered. So these are the heads of all of these tribes that we've just seen in the book of Numbers that have been numbered. And they brought their offering before Yahuwah. 6 covered wagons, 12 oxen, a wagon for every 2 of the princes. So 12 tribes, 12 oxen, but 6 covered wagons. And for each one an ox, they presented them before the Mishkan. And Yahuwah spoke to Moshe, and he said, take of them, that it may be that they do the service of the tent of meeting. You give them to the Levites, to every man according to his service. So Moshe took the wagons and the oxen. He gave them to the Levites. 2 wagons, 4 oxen he gave to the sons of Gershon for their service. Four wagons, eight oxen to the sons of Merari, according to their service. And this, again, is under the hand of Ithamar, son of Aaron the priest. To the sons of Kohath, he didn't give any. Why? Well, because the sons of the service of the set-apart things belonged to them, and they bore them by hand. They bore them literally upon their shoulders. That's the poles, remember, that went through things like the table of showbread and the ark and so forth. The princes brought the dedication offering of the altar, and the day it was anointed, even the princes brought their offering before Yahuwah. And Yahuwah said to Moshe, they shall present their offering, each prince on his day, for the dedication of the altar. So, here we get to the listing. And he that presented his offering on the first day was Nachshon, son of Amminadab of the tribe of Judah. So Judah goes first. The man's name is Nachshon. His offering was, and I'll read it all, and what we're going to see is this paragraph is repeated literally verbatim, over and over and over and over and over. His offering was one silver dish, the weight thereof was 130 shekels, one silver basin of 70 shekels, after the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mingled with oil for a mincha, a meal offering, one golden pan of 10 shekels full of incense, one young bullock, one ram, one he lamb of the first year for a burnt offering, one male of the goats for a chatat, a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of Shalamim, two oxen, five rams, five he-goats, five he-lambs of the first year. This was the offering of Nachshon, the son of Amminadab. And then guess what? On the second day, we're going to see the identical set of things being offered. The only difference is the name. On the second day, and of course today, Nathaniel, the son of Zuar, prince of Issachar, he did offer. He presented for his offering, right? One silver dish, the weight thereof was 130 shekels, one silver basin, 70 shekels, the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour, mingled with oil for a meal offering, golden pan of 10 shekels full of incense, one young bullock, one ram. We get the idea, right? We've read this before. We're going to read it 10 more times. On the third day, Eliab, son of Helon, prince of the children of Zebulun, we know what his offering was, but the Torah is going to repeat it for us. His offering was one silver dish, weight thereof 130 shekels, and so on. On the fourth day, what's different? Elitzur, the son of Shedeur, prince of the children of Reuben. His offering, right? One silver dish, weight thereof 130 shekels, and we know the rest. On the fifth day, Shelumiel, son of Zurishaddai, the prince of the children of Simeon. His offering, oh yeah, you know it, one silver dish, weight thereof 130 shekels, one silver basin of 70 shekels, and exactly the same. And yet, each one of these merits a complete repetition of the entire thing. They're unique to the extent that they're worthy of note, and yet they're all identical. Interesting. And, of course, there are some other things I think that we can kind of begin to guess. One, there's a certain unanimity of purpose here, isn't there? All right, the sixth day, it's Eliasaph, son of Deuel, prince of the children of Gad. We know what his offering is, one silver dish, 130 shekels. Seventh day, Elishama. Now, that would be the Sabbath, it would seem. Son of Amihud, prince of the children of Ephraim. His offering, one silver dish, 130 shekels, and the like. On the eighth day, Gamaliel, son of Pedajur, prince of the children of Manasseh. His offering, one silver dish. Ninth day, Abidan, the son of Gideoni, prince of the children of Benjamin. His offering, again, one silver dish, 130 shekels, and the rest. On the tenth day, Ahiezer, the son of Amishaddai, prince of the children of Dan. You know what his offering was, but we're going to see it. On the 11th day, Pagiel, son of Ochron, the prince of the children of Asher. Again, one silver dish, 130 shekels, and the rest. On the 12th day, Ahira, the son of Anon, prince of the children of Naphtali. His offering was, right, you can almost say it with me, can't you? One silver dish, the weight thereof was 130 shekels, one silver basin of 70 shekels, after the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mingled with oil for a meal offering, one golden pan of 10 shekels full of incense, and so forth. This, it says, after the complete repetition of all 12 unique but identical offerings, was the dedication offering of the altar in the day when it was anointed at the hands of the princes of Israel. And now, guess what? As if we hadn't been able to put it together, the Torah is going to give us yet more redundancy, or it seems. But also, folks, this is a way of doing error correction, because if you go through the math, you're going to find out all this should add up. Okay, at the hands of the princes of Israel, 12 silver dishes, 12 silver basins, 12 golden pans. Each dish, we can guess it, 130 shekels. Each basin weighed 70. All the silver of the vessels, now we're going to add them all up. 2,400 shekels after the shekel of the sanctuary. 12 golden pans gives the weight. All the gold of the pans, 120 shekels. The oxen, total of 12. The oxen for the sacrifice of Shalamim, 24 bulls, 60 rams, 60 he-goats, he-lambs of the first year, 60. This is the dedication offering of the altar. After that, it was anointed. And then the final verse in the chapter, the longest one in the Torah, verse 89. And when Moshe went in to the Ohel, the tent of meeting, that he might speak unto him, then he heard the voice. And that word is kol, interestingly. Speaking to him from above the ark cover that was upon the ark of the testimony, from between the two cherubim, and he spoke unto him. Now that is the end of this first portion, Naso. But as I said, because we want to catch up a little bit, I'm going to read into chapter 8. This portion is after it says, Yahuwah spoke to Moshe, speak unto Aaron and say to him, when you light the lamps, all right, Bechukotai, those seven lamps shall give light in front of the menorah. So Aaron did so. He lighted the lamp so as to give light in front of the menorah, as Yahuwah commanded Moshe. And I'm not going to read the entire portion. We're going to pause, and you'll see why it is that I think this is a good place when we get there that we'll pause. This was the work of the menorah, right? It was a beaten work of gold, the base and the flowers, all of one beaten work. According to the pattern which Yahuwah had shown Moshe, so he made the menorah. Now, some of the English renderings say the candlestick, and I always thought that was kind of a tacky rendering. There's nothing like this. This is the menorah. Everybody sees a seven-branch lampstand. We know, oh, that's what it's called. It's called a menorah. And there's no English translation because it's a menorah. And the candlestick doesn't cut it. All right. Yahuwah then spoke to Moshe, and he said, take the Levites from among the Bnei Israel and cleanse them. So this is all of those tribes we've been talking about. And this is what you're going to do to them, to cleanse them. Sprinkle the water of purification upon them. Let them to cause a razor to pass over all of their flesh. Let them wash their clothes and cleanse themselves. Take a young bull with its meal offering, its mincha, fine flour mingled with oil, and another young bull for a chatat, and present the Levites before the tent of meeting. And you shall assemble kol edat, the whole congregation of the Bnei Israel. Present the Levites before Yahuwah, and the Bnei Israel shall lay their hands upon the Levites. Wow. Now, we know that there's 8,000 of the age of 30 through 50, but it sounds like, and again, it's not specific, but the general reading, the things you'll see in the Midrash seem to suggest this is all 22,000, younger and older Levites too. So it's not just 8,580, but arguably, it's all 22,000. And Aaron shall offer the Levites before Yahuwah for a wave offering from the Bnei Israel, that they might be able to do the service of Yahuwah. Going to wave 22,000 Levites before Yahuwah. Now, that's kind of a fascinating scene, right? Do the wave. I mean, you know, literally like an entire, but it's much bigger than just a football stadium with 80 or 100,000 people. There are millions in the desert. They're going to lay their hands on and wave 22,000 Levites. Levites shall lay their hands upon the heads of the bullocks, offer the one for a chatat and the other for an olah, sin offering, burnt offering, and to Yahuwah, and to make atonement for the Levites. And then you set the Levites before Aaron and before his sons and offer them for a wave offering unto Yahuwah. Thus you shall separate the Levites from among the Bnei Israel, and the Levites are mine. After that shall the Levites go in, do the service of the tent of meeting, and you shall cleanse them and offer them for a wave offering. Because they are wholly mine. They are given to me from among the Bnei Israel. Chatat. In place of. There's that word again. In place of all that open the womb. Even the firstborn of all the Bnei Israel. I have taken them unto me. So remember, there's about 22,000. There was a difference there, but it was pretty close. Of the firstborn of Israel and of the Levites. because all the firstborn among the children of Israel are mine, both man and beast. On the day that I smote all the firstborn in the land of Mitzrayim, I set them apart, I sanctified them for me. And I have taken the Levites, Tehat, in place of all the firstborn among the Bnei Israel. And I've given the Levites, they're given to Aaron and to his sons, from among the Bnei Israel, to do the service of the children of Israel in the tent of meeting, and to make atonement for the children of Israel, that there is no plague or be no plague among the Bnei Israel, even though the children of Israel come nigh, through the children of Israel, coming nigh into the sanctuary. So we don't want a plague, because they might get too close. Thus did Moshe and Aaron, and Kol Ha'edot, all of the congregation of the Bnei Israel, to the Levites, according to all the Yahuwah commanded Moshe, touching the Levites, so the children of Israel did to them. And the Levites purified themselves, they washed their clothes, Aaron offered them for a sacred gift before Yahuwah, Aaron made atonement for them to cleanse them, and after that, the Levites went in to do the service of the tent of meeting, the Avodah, before Aaron and before his sons, as Yahuwah had commanded Moshe according to the Levites, so they did unto them. Then it says, and Yahuwah spoke to Moshe, and he said, this is that which pertains unto the Levites. From 20 and 5 years old, so 25 upwards, they go in to perform the service in the work of the tent of meeting. And the age of 50 years old, they return from that service. They don't serve anymore. But they shall in fact now minister, so after they kind of retire from the service, they're still going to minister with their brethren at the tent of meeting to keep the charge, but they do no manner of other service. Thus shall they do unto the Levites, touching their charges. And then finally, chapter 9 is going to talk about what seems to be the only, at least so far as we know, Pesach sacrifice in the service in the wilderness. So it says, Yahuwah spoke to Moshe in Bamidbar Sinai, in the first month of the second year after they'd come out of Egypt. And he said, let the children of Israel keep the Pesach in its appointed season. In the 14th day of this month, at dusk, you keep it in its appointed season, according to all the statutes, the Echukhat, and according to all the ordinances, you shall keep it. So Moshe spoke to the Bnei Israel, saying they should keep the Pesach. And they did. They kept it in the first month, 14th day of the month, at dusk, in, or Bamidbar Sinai, according to all Yahuwah commanded Moshe. So they did. But there were certain men who were unclean because they had come in contact with a dead body of somebody. So they couldn't do it. They couldn't keep that Passover on that day. They came before Moshe and before Aaron, and those men said to him, look, hey, we got a problem here. We are unclean by the dead body of a man. So wherefore are we to be kept back so as not to bring the offering of Yahuwah and its appointed season among the Bnei Israel? This is a big deal. We want to participate. What are we going to do? Moshe said to them, stay here, so I can see what Yahuwah will command concerning you. So he's going to ask. And Yahuwah spoke to him, and he said, speak unto the Bnei Israel, tell them all. In other words, if any man of you, of your generations, shall be unclean. Now he's going to expand it just a bit here, not just by reason of a dead body, that's one of the things, by reason of a dead body, or he happens to be on a journey far off, yet he shall keep the Passover unto Yahuwah. And instead he does it in the second month, on the 14th day at dusk, they shall keep it. So a month later, it's been referred to as the second Passover. They eat it with, as you would expect, unleavened bread and bitter herbs. They don't leave any of it till morning, nor break a bone thereof. According to all the statutes of the Pesach, they shall keep it. But if the man's clean, and he's not on a journey, and he doesn't bother to keep the Passover, that soul shall be cut off from among his people. So he can't just say, oh, it's inconvenient, I ain't going to do it. If he's not meeting the requirements, he has not contacted a dead body, or he's not on a journey far off, then he has not done what he should have done. He's not brought the offering of Yahuwah in its appointed season. That man shall bear his sin. Now, if there's a stranger sojourning among you, and he would like to keep the Pesach of Yahuwah, according to the statute and according to the ordinance thereof, so shall he do. You shall have one chuk, a chuk, this would be a chuk echad, chukha echad, both for the stranger and for him that is born in the land. And on the day of the tabernacle was reared up, the cloud covered the Mishkan, the tabernacle, even the tent of the testimony, and at evening there was upon the Mishkan, as it were, the appearance of fire till morning. So it was always. Cloud covered it, the appearance of fire by night. Whenever the cloud was taken up from over the tent, after that, the Bnei Israel journeyed, and the place where the cloud abode, that's where they camped. At the commandment of Yahuwah, the children of Israel journeyed, and at the commandment of Yahuwah, they encamped. So long as the cloud stayed there upon the Mishkan, the tabernacle, they remained in camp. And when the cloud tarried upon the tabernacle for a long time, many days, the children of Israel kept the charge of Yahuwah. They didn't move. They stayed. They journeyed not. Sometimes the cloud was upon the Mishkan for just a few days. According to the commandment of Yahuwah, they remained encamped. And according to the commandment of Yahuwah, they journeyed. So they don't know how long they're going to be there, but they're going to wait until it moves. Sometimes the cloud was there from morning until evening, and when the cloud was taken up in the morning, they journeyed. Or, if it continued by day and by night, when the cloud was taken up, they went. Whether it was 2 days or a month or a year after the cloud tarried upon the Mishkan, abiding thereon, the Bnei Israel remained. They stayed encamped. And they journeyed not, but when it was taken up, they journeyed. I mean, he's making this real clear. When it moves, you move. When it stays, you stay. At the commandment of Yahuwah, they encamped. And at the commandment of Yahuwah, they journeyed. They kept the charge of Yahuwah at the commandment of Yahuwah by the hand of Moshe. And finally, chapter 10, Yahuwah then spoke to Moshe, and he said, "Get yourself two trumpets made out of silver. Of beaten work you make them. They're going to be for you to use for calling of the congregation, Ha'idah, and for causing the camps to set forward." So, we know when it's time to move, because the cloud moves. But when it's time for individual camps, in other words, the individual 12 tribes, to take up and join in the parade and in the movement, that is what the shofars are going to be for, these silver trumpets. When they blow with them, kol ha'edot, all the congregation gathers themselves unto you at the door of the tent of meeting. And when they blow but with one of them, though, then the princes, the heads of the thousands of Israel, shall gather themselves. So, everybody, you get two of them. It's just the princes, the leaders, you get one. When you blow an alarm, a teruah, and that's the staccato blast, nine blasts, then the camps that lie on the east side, they take up their journey. When you blow an alarm the second time, it's the camps on the south side, so they go east, south, west, north, right? They blow an alarm. When the assemblies be gathered together, you blow, but don't sound the alarm, the teruah. And the sons of Aaron, the priest, shall blow with the trumpets, and they shall be to you for a, here we go, hukat olam, statute forever, throughout your generations. Now when you go to war in your land against the adversary that oppresses you, then you shall sound an alarm with those trumpets, and you shall be remembered before Yahuwah your El, and you shall be saved from your enemies. Also, in the day of your gladness, in your appointed seasons, the times of your new moons, Rosh Chodesh, you blow with the trumpets over your burnt offerings and over the sacrifices of your Shalemim, and they shall be to you for a memorial before your El, Ani Yahuwah Elohim. Now it came to pass in the second year, in the second month, 20th day of the month, the cloud was taken up from over the tabernacle of the testimony. So what does that mean? It's time to move. Children of Israel set forth by their stages out of the wilderness of Sinai. And the cloud abode in the wilderness of Paran. They took their first journey according to the commandment of Yahuwah by the hand of Moshe. Now this is why I'm going to go through this section and then we're going to pause. And so we're not going to complete the entire Torah portion, but I do think this is fascinating because if we go through what we see here, again, there is some repetition. Does that sound a little familiar? And we're also going to note that these are all of the very same men. That makes sense. The same leaders as we saw in chapter 7. They are going to be repeated, each individual name. In the first place, the standard of the camp of the children of Judah set forward according to their host. Over his host was, right, Nachshon, son of Amminadab. Over the host of the tribe of Issachar, Nathaniel, son of Zuar. Over Zebulun, Eliab, son of Helon. And the tabernacle was taken down. So we're going to see that there's a process here, right? The first three go, then the tabernacle's taken down. The sons of Gershom, sons of Merari, they bore the tabernacle. They set forward. And then, after the tabernacle is moved out, then what? We're going to move to the south side. And the standard of the camp of Reuben set forward, according to their host. Over him, over them, was Elitzur, son of Shedur. And then, over the host of the tribe of Simeon, Shelumiel, son of Zerushaddai. And over the tribe of the children of Gad, Eliasaph, the son of Deuel. And then the Kohathites, bearers of the sanctuary, they set forward so that the tabernacle, the Mishkan, might be set up against their coming. So you notice that this is the stuff that's on the inside is going after the outside is already moved forward, so it'll be ready when they get there. The standard of the camp of the children of Ephraim set forward. This time it's Elishama, son of Ammihud, then Manasseh, Gamaliel, son of Pedahzur, over the tribe of Benjamin, Abidan, son of Gideoni. And then the standard of the camp of Dan, of the rearward of all camps, set forward according to their hosts. So, of Dan, you got Ahiezer, son of Amishaddai, over the tribe of the Asher, Pagiel, son of Ochran, and finally, over at Naphtali, Ahira, son of Anan. These, it says, were the journeyings of the Bani Israel according to their hosts, and they set forward. Now, we're almost done. This is almost the end of chapter 10, and it's kind of interesting because now we're going to see, who's this guy? Moshe said unto Hobab, the son of Reuel the Midianite, Moshe's father-in-law. Okay, so here's the question. Is this the same guy that we've seen called Yitro? Or is it a different father-in-law? Well, we do know that Moshe eventually had two wives. It's not clear. It is, however, the general assumption, and I'll just note it that way, the Midrash mostly suggests that Hobab and Reuel, one of the two at least, is this guy we know as Yitro, a Cohen of Midianites. One of them is Moshe's father-in-law. We're journeying back to the place of Yahuwah, which where he said, I'll give it to you. Come unto us and we'll do you good, for Yahuwah has spoken good concerning Israel. And he said to him, I'm not going to go, but I'll depart to my own land and to my own kin. That sounds like what we've seen before, doesn't it? And he said, don't leave us, I pray you, because as much as you know how we're to encamp in the wilderness, you shall be unto us instead of eyes. In other words, you're kind of like a guide. We're going to count on you. It shall be if you go with us, yea, it shall be that what is good soever Yahuwah shall do unto us, the same will do to you. So they set forward from the Mount of Yahuwah, 3 days' journey. The Ark of the Covenant of Yahuwah went before them, 3 days' journey, to seek out a resting place for them. And the cloud over them by day, they set forward. And it came to pass when, let's pause there. I'll go ahead and read it. We'll start this again last time. This is an interesting phrase. It's also a what's called the inverted noons. And you may have heard this. This is sometimes referred to the book that was never written, as if there's a whole lot that goes on between these inverted noons. But in any case, we're going to recognize this. So it came to pass, whenever the ark sent forward, that Moshe said, Rise up, O Yahuwah, and let your enemies be scattered. Let those that hate you flee from before you. And when it rested, he said, Return, O Yahuwah, unto the 10,000s of the families of Israel. So with that, folks, we'll pause. And again, that was a long portion, but what we're going to do here is eventually catch up. And of course, there is a lot of stuff in these portions, and I think there are some kind of interesting combinations. We'll talk about those when we go through some of the Midrash tomorrow.